like throwing pebbles down. If you exchange a sheep or goats, you put so many pebbles in one to each, you see, and balance them. The word calculate means use pebbles. So the idea of Simon is a separating counter. He analyzes. And Peter means a stone, and the stone is already the principle of separativity. So when his name is Simon, then he says, I will call you Peter. Because upon petrifaction, that is, the stoniness of things, is base clarity. There's no clarity in the world other than that based on matter. The material world, you can cut it. Your emotional world, you can't. There's no clarity in feeling, is there? Clarity is in those things which you can cut. And the stone is a particular example of the final stage of matter. Stone as an inorganic, non-living matter is the basis of counting. Peter is the same as Peter, father. Sakti Pitri is the same. Pitri Pater Peter. Because the father of all things is first of all the compaction of power, and that compaction makes a stone. And stone means S-T-1, self-crucified one. That's S-T-N, Satan. This is the identity of the two opposites. So you see that the separative activity, separative counting, which is Simon, is correctly called Peter, based on stone, on materiality. In the Old Testament, Simeon and Levi kill a man to their own hurt. Just they digged a wall and slew a man to their own hurt. Simeon means self-counting, separative counting. And Levi means perception. Till the two things together cut you in bits. When your emotions separate things and say, I don't want them to do with that, I do want them to do with this, that's separative. That's Simeon or Simon's. Levy means perception, the balance between the outside and the in. Have that pencil there.
Okay.
Supposing we take, I draw it down here, let me put it down. We take the letter S, look at the old form of it, and you can see it actually drawn with the tongue of the snake. That is, a serpent. And it already means life. So in the Old Testament we find at a certain point the Jews are in trouble with a serpent. And Moses makes one of brass and puts it on a T-cross. And it symbolizes the control of the natural appetite, that's the serpent, by analysis of the time process. Later on, Christ says, as Moses lifted up the serpent, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. That is to say, we can control the natural appetite by clarity of thinking. So this T and this S want only N, which means motion, continuity, to make Satan. And the symbol of the cross means passivity and activity producing at the intersection there the stone. So the cross itself symbolizes existence. If we exist, it is a proof that we are an intersection of forces. Some of the forces of the earth, some of the forces from outside the earth, like the solar forces. Cosmic forces are intersecting. That line represents the Earth, and this line represents forces from outside the Earth coming in. And the whole process is contained in this word, Satan. And popularly, there's a lot of misconception about him. They think that Satan is bad. But he's not bad. We'll show why he's not bad. When we come to consider all that is, we draw a circle. That is the letter O. When we want to represent each that is, we put a cross in it. And at the intersection point is an each. That is an individual. That individual is made of forces from above and forces on the earth. So this symbol symbolizes all that is. And if you remember, what we did with it was say we want to express this all and each relation very carefully and analyze it. So we take half of it and half of it, we've broken the circle. Then we take the cross out and put it up there, and we take the cross out and put it up there. And we now have two signs. The one with the cross on the top is called Saturn, astronomically, which we said was the urn of being. Sat is being, urn of being. And breath, Saturn. And it implies the dominion of time over eternity, or the bound fix over the free. And the other one, this way up, is the dominion of free over bound. And we call that one Jupiter. And there's the Peter again in there. Jupiter means God, Jupiter, God the Father. So these two, Satan, Saturn, and Jupiter, are the two halves of one whole, and they presuppose each other. That means you can't have one without the other. Throw away this concept, and there is no difference in anything you do. You've no sense of value. Value depends on opposition. So this sign contains all there is. Now, if we put the serpent with his tail in his mouth, binding that, that is the original meaning of the word ocean. The serpent that girdles the earth in the Greek. If we draw the Greek universe, we draw a sphere, and we girdle it with the serpent, biting himself. And above is called heaven, in the Greek analysis, and below is Tartarus. And this is dark. That's where all the titans get locked up. That's where all the gods dwell. And this is a very simple diagram of the universe. Now the queen holds a thing called a mon, or orb. And it is the same concept. We call this the sign of rulership. And it is said to mean the rulership of Christ, the crucified, over the world. This symbolizes man. There is the undifferentiated part that corresponds with your belly. There's your diaphragm. Then the differentiated part, the two lungs in the chest. And then the most fixed part of all, the intellect. Where fixity is the sign of that cross. Now you know the crucifixion of Peter was done at his request, upside down. You know, when he was crucified, he said, please do me upside down. Why? Do you remember we said before that if you take this sign, this top part means spirit, this part means soul, and this part means body. Now the funny thing about spirit is this. It is not bound in any sense, like soul is, and therefore no definition of any good or evil applies to spirit. Because all definitions imply a cutting, a separation of it, this, not this. The right presupposes the left, the above, the below. In spirit those oppositions do not exist. But in the realm of the soul, they do. The Greek word, which we translate spirit, is nous. I'll write it in English letters, then you can see it. That's nous. This is psyche, and forget the word psychology. And this one is soma, body. Now, the essential characteristic of the soma is this: it doesn't act unless it is impinged upon from outside by a force. We'll shade it black. That is like the stone. That's the black stone at Mecca in the Kaaba. It has to be pushed from outside. So we say a person who is not willing has to be pushed. And the idea of a being existing which cannot move itself is the idea of the stone. But the next level of the soul can reason. It can go round. It can keep going round and examine all it's got. And this process we call discursive reason. Discursive means running and analysing. Curse, run. Dis, analysis. Analytical running, it means. Down here, this pressure on the body we will call sensation. The Greek word for that is aesthetos, whence we get the word aesthetic. We've got the discursive reasoning there. Sensation, stimulus from outside. This one stimulates itself inside in the process called reasoning. And above here we have not reasoning serially, that is one after the other. We have a simultaneous process which is called intuition generally, but it means non-discursive awareness. We can call it intuitive comprehension. Comprehension means grasping all of it at once. Comprehension. So there are three processes. The lowest kind of thing is like this, cannot move unless I push it. That is the somatic body. A sensation. I press on here until it hurts, and then my leg tries to move away. If I stroke it carefully, it'll come towards it because it's pleasant. That's the kind we talked about, the tactic reaction. That is the lowest kind of thing, because the force is applied from outside. It is not controlling itself. The next kind of thing is when it begins to think about all the sensations that have come to it from whatever sources, and it begins to add them up. So we say that the special activity of the soul is discursive reasoning. The rational process in you is something you do in your soul. But the soul itself is only a rotation of spirit, and in the spirit you don't need to reason, you grasp immediately the whole meaning of a thing. We call it intuitive comprehension. Spiritual awareness is not a discursive reasoning process, it's a simultaneous grasp of the whole. You can get some rough idea of it if we say that if I hold my hand up, from where you are you can see simultaneously five digits, function. But from where I am, if I put my eye very close and look at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it takes me 5 seconds of time to count them. You can see from where you are 5. But if I get too close to it, I am forced to analyze in time what can be comprehended immediately, simultaneously, if I'm far enough away. So the symbol of this spirit is an eagle. So if we draw ourselves a comical eagle up there at the crown, there's an eagle. This begins to look like a standard of the olden times. As a matter of fact, in the old Roman, you'll find this sort of thing mounted on a pole. Something drawn in there, and this is the eagle. The eagle is sacred to St. John the Divine, because the eagle flies up very, very high and comprehends the whole landscape simultaneously. And then if there's a sick ox down there, he's watching. If there's another one over there, he's watching that. He's also watching other eagles in the sky. If one eagle dives onto a corpse, he immediately goes down to where it is. Therefore, the Bible says, where the body is, there will the eagles be gathered together. Because they actually fly at certain distances from each other, like the vultures do. So if one dies, they know that there's something worth having and they all go. So they represent the high-flying, intuitive sense. You have to get right up above things before you can understand what it's about. So a person in a very intimate relation with another person, right at the material level, is disqualified from understanding the meaning of that relation. You can't understand a relation unless you climb up out of it, stand back and look at it. But if you are too close to somebody, you might be able to count the pores in their skin. But you can't understand the psychology of the owner of the skin. You've got to get back, stand back, and try to feel the whole relation simultaneously. Now, you remember when we were talking about meditation, I'll put inside there a little handout to show it's a rotating process discussion. We talked about your physical body being stimulated from outside, and the reaction tendency appearing, and if the reaction is not controlled, you are a slave to the stimulus. And if you can begin to think about the meaning of it, then you can inhibit the tendency to react. We said that if somebody comes and insults you, if you're not careful, you will immediately let that energy go out, which went in your ears, into your brain, along your nerves, onto your tongue, and you say another rude word back. In which case, that person has got his own back. The person that fed you the stimulus. He's got the same energy back in another form. But we said, if you can take the stimulus and turn it round inside you, and not let it out, you will heap coals of fire on his head, because actually he lives by your reaction to his stimulus. In daily life, you'll find that if you say something to somebody, they tend to say something back. And if they say something to you, you tend to say something back. But if you stop and say nothing back, after a few moments, the fellow will say, what do you think about that? Didn't you hear me? He wants to know. He wants to be fed. Remember, when you say something to somebody, you're actually feeding them. So that if they stimulate you by saying one word, and you give them 10 words, they made a profit of 9 words. And it's energy. It has to be realized that speech is energy. That the words that come in at your ears are feeding you. They may be feeding you poison, like bad words, irrationalities, and so on. Or they may be feeding you good words, like truth, which integrate together. The important thing to realize is that it is energy. And if you let it out, you lose it. So, suppose when we say here is a relation between two people, and this one fires a stimulus, there's a reaction, emotion inside. If he manages to stop it before it gets there and bouncing out, and starts the turning process, which always occurs, it becomes discursive reason spontaneously. Shortly we'll do a little experiment to prove that, if you like. But this discursive or rotating process is actually building energy into your body. It is making you stronger than that other man. So that when his stimulus comes and no reaction comes back to him, he sends another impulse to see what you've done with the first one. And if you remain very, very silent, he'll send a lot more. He may actually kick you on the head. It has been now. And this is the meaning of Christ's silence during his trial. When Pilate says to him, you're not saying anything in your defense. Do you not know that I have power over you to take your life or let you live? And then he speaks, he says, you have no power other than that given to you from above. And notice he's very, very subtle. He's always double. That's the meaning of these horns. It's always devil talk. Because he might have meant Caesar and he might have meant God, and he didn't say which. If Pilate believed in God, then he would be afraid of God. But if he didn't believe in God, he would at least be afraid of Caesar. There's always something that somebody is afraid of. So Pilate is firing energy at Christ in the cross questioning, He said nothing for a long time. He's waiting for the builder. And then he lets out a tiny little bit. You have no power other than that from above. Whereupon, Pilate's mind goes up and remembers Caesar, and maybe it remembers God. It is certainly carried out of the realm of Pilate, who is already the Pilor, crucified man, the rationalist man. So the whole process is a process of gaining energy by continence, containingness. Continence means simply containingness. Somebody says something, can you take it in? And instead of hitting out, feed on it. Actually, when you're used to it, it doesn't matter if what is said to you is rubbish. Because even rubbish is energy. And it can be used like manure. You can get very good roses out of manure. You can get very good sense out of rubbish. But if it's genuine rubbish, you can invert it and become sense. It's all a question of knowing what to do with the energy that comes in. So, when we talk about Peter, we're talking about this function. Pi, we said that was the pi ratio. The pi r and t. This is Peter r. Peter means the stone, and the whole question of ratio is this. We must drop a pebble onto the waters of existence, and then we will get ripples spreading out. And the ripples are a function, remember we did this diagram before, a function of what we call pi ratio. Point application of pebble produces ripples, and always the radius there has a definite relation with the circumference. The radius here has a relation with this circumference. The radius here with this one. The radius here with this one. So there's a definite relationship between the impact of the pebble on the materiality, the simple resilient substance, and the distance to which it travels and the height of the waves and so on. We call that pi ratio. And we said if we add to it h for height, we have another ratio called the height ratio or horatio. If we drop it from a very high place, we get very big waves, and then from a low place, tiny waves. There's a definite relationship between the height that the pebble drops and the type of wave that appears. And there's our cross again. The passivity, or water, or materiality, the activity, or spirit force, coming in. If we think about that, we'll find that Peter means every conceivable kind of material, analytical, rational process. And later we'll find that he is therefore, in a certain sense, a reincarnation of Cain. Because Cain is coin. Coin. The cornerstone. You know, coinage is called currency. It has been called by one of our best right-wing brains, the lifeblood of the nation, currency, coinage. Coinage means this pebble dash trick. It's a facade, pebble dash. You cover reality with pebbles, and then you count the pebbles and ignore the reality. This is called petrifaction. You can treat your friends as individuals and ignore their feelings. That's treating them as pebbles. You can count all the people you know as physical entities occupying seats in buses and trains and think, well, that one is on the seat that I sit on as a rule, get rid of that pebble, without any regard for the feeling. So this method of pebbling, as it used to be called, or calculating as we now call it, this pebbling is a method of avoiding a real relationship between people. Just count that being as an individual, a material individual, and then ignore all its feelings. And you can have a very, very simple life. It isn't difficult at all to have a fundamentally simple life if you ignore the truth that people are sentient, that they have feelings, and treat them simply as ones or pebbles in the world. But we find, for instance, that Peter betrays Christ three times, doesn't he? He denies him three times. And we've got our three-part body again, and we'll see why. We have a primary urge, which has a definite purpose, a feeling, and a thinking process. The primary urge there has to do with food take and procreation. The betrayal of it is done when a person pursues another person purely physically, from the point of view of body contact, and deliberately avoids the consequences of the physical relationship. Thus we say that if people have sexual relationships and take very great care that they never have any children, that is a betrayal of that function. That is Peter, the counting process. He's having a material relation which nature has made pleasant, and he's having the relationship with the pleasantry, and at the same time he's cutting off the consequences, he's counting. So if he merely does that, he's a pure hedonist, and at the same time, he is betraying that part of his being. Now another relation is the emotional relation between people. You say, this person is pleasant, this other person is unpleasant. And you can say, well, I'm going to have a relationship with this person, I know this person is kind, so I'm going to come with it, and because that person is kind, I'm going to get an introduction to another man in order to collect some pebbles from him, namely get an introduction through somebody you like in business to another man whom you don't know, and you're going through a person you like to get at another man. That is called using this person as the means and the other man as the end of your function. And philosophically, it is always wrong to use a human being as a means to an end. Human beings are said to be ends in themselves, that is, their purpose is in themselves. And if you use a person only as a means to something else, you have reduced them to the level of a pebble again, to a stone. So there is a betrayal of the emotional attachment. Somebody is fond of you, and you use their fondness to get an introduction to a material benefit. That goes on daily in business. The third betrayal is in your thought. Some ideas are ideas which make you efficient, and some make you inefficient. To tie yourself to the efficient ideas, to become very, very clever, in order to get into the material world again and get something for yourself, that is a betrayal of your thinking process. Thus, if we take the psychology of salesmanship, we know that certain men specialize in high-pressure salesmanship to sell rubbish. So they study the truth of toxic law, the fact that people respond to stimuli presented in a certain way, but they don't stimulate those people for the sake of the people, but for the sake of the sales. So they're using a rational process and betraying it. And now we have the three betrayals of Peter: the reduction of urge, procreation, to simple contact of body and sensuous experience; reduction of an emotional tie to a means to introduction to another being; reduction of truth to a device for taking advantage of other beings. Three levels of betrayal. These things tend to occur if you don't watch them all the time. If you sit down and write down all the people you know, and then be very, very truthful and say why you want to keep up a relation with each one of them, and why you want to get rid of the relations with some of them, you will find in general that this kind of betrayal tends to go on. Some you are having to deal with because they're, in the words of a young man, that girl has got a good pair of legs. So that's good enough for that relation. We don't care about anything else. This one is very, very warm-hearted and brings toffees and never asks for any back. So we'll cultivate her. This one can think and gets very, very good ideas from her other boyfriend who is technical, I'm kind to her, she'll tell me the latest process for manufacturing rubber dollars which I can sell, and so on. Now, these processes tend to go on. So if we want to gain this power of reflexive self-consciousness, the containingness, if we want to get the same kind of power that Christ had when Pilate was talking to him, we can only do it by conquering that kind of threefold betrayal. Now, we can tie this up with the idea of duty, because this duty is a very interesting word. That Jew, if we put the I in that used to be there, we still pronounce it in English. That is God, that is crucifixion, that is integration. Now, it is said that duty is the shadow of love. It means to say that that thing which is called duty is the thing that you would spontaneously do if you were already a nice type. But as we're not nice types yet, we have to do it out of a sense of duty. Once upon a time in the Golden Age, it was done because people felt that it was better to be good than to be bad. That's called the Golden Age, the age of will, spontaneous goodwill. Then there arose the silver men, the men who thought about those actions. And the silver men became very, very cunning, for which Zeus, the great father of the Greek gods, destroyed them all. In other words, they all became neurotic through this counting process. Duty is the shadow of love means God has said what should be done, that's D-I-U, if we wrote it in the Latin form, that V is the same as U, we then have div, which is the root of divinity. That's God. This T is the cross, again, the Tau. In the Hebrew we write it like that. That's the Resh, letter R, peace on makes T, Tau, crucifixion and integration. Circle divided into three parts. One, two, three. Here we are again. So duty means God is crucified in order to integrate. Your duty is that activity which you should do if you wish to integrate. If you do it spontaneously, you don't call it duty. You just say, well, I'm naturally good. And if you don't do it that way, then you say, I'm doing my duty. The point is that duty is only what God has commanded, and which human beings find irksome because they're a bit dark in their understanding. So the concept of duty isn't really a very difficult one. We have the big circle for macrocosmos, and it works in a very definite manner. And then we have the solar system, the planetary systems. We put the Earth in the middle with a cross in it. On there is a man. And extend that cross straight through. As the Stoics saw long ago, the universe is essentially logical. So, that thing which appears down here is logically necessary, we call it duty. But if our consciousness is expanded, we call it the natural, spontaneous thing to do. So, up here in cosmic consciousness, it is love, which is the L, Orbe, the cosmic egg, working for the cosmic egg, working for development of your potentiality. And the internal shadow cast in the material world is duty. So if you can find any duties and deliberately do them, it means that you will start integrating your three parts together. Your thinking and your feeling and your doing will become unified. If you do your duty. The Germans have a funny word for duty, which shows you what they think about it. The German word for duty is Pflicht, which is related to the English afflict. It is that which is painful. And when they say, deine Pflicht erkennen und tun, das ist der Hauptsache, they mean that it's nothing so very, very important as to get people who think the truth is an affliction to do it and discover. It really is quite useful. When we talk about truth, remember putting a screwdriver in the slot of a screw is the true way of getting that screw to go into the wood. But if we decide, well, we won't do it that way, we're going to do it with the end of a matchbox or something like that, or a pair of worn-out pliers gripped around the edge. Sometimes we have to do that. We can't get it quite up to the wood that way, can we? It's not the right tool. Using the right tool for the right job is truth. Truth is simply the proper formal relationship between things. So, this is the realm of truth up here, the proper relation. There's the head of your screw, there's the driver. The proper relation, the cross, all the time. Christ says, take up your daily cross. The daily cross is the situation which you are in, and your will applied. At the intersection point called the present moment, apply your will, and there is the cross. So we see that the concept of duty is not very difficult. It simply means that activity which we would do spontaneously if we were already decent, but which in the absence of that we have to have a rule about it. And the rule is based on the fact that the universe is round, that everything must come back again, like the boomerang, to the hand of the thrower. And consequently, man had better be careful what kind of force he releases, because the space-time curvature of the universe, which Einstein would say, will enable a man with very good eyesight to see the back of his own head. You know that light travels around the universe. It means if a man with very good eyes were to look that way, as light travels all the way around, he would see the back of his own head. And this is the basis of the Indian concept of karma, of action-reaction. Whatever force you release, it will just travel around the universe, come back and hit you in the back of the head. If you've written on it nice words, I love you, it goes all the way around there, and comes back and says, I love you. And if you say, I hate you, it goes all the way around, it comes back and says, I hate you. It's very important to realize this. You cannot release a cause without producing an effect. Now, because cause and effect is very often separated in time, people tend to think that only some things are causes and something is an effect and not everything. So in Indian metaphysics we find this karma or causation doctrine says some causes are immediate, like insulting a man bigger than yourself by hitting him, thereupon he probably hits you back because he's big enough. That's called the immediate effect. And that's called short-term effect, where you hit a man smaller than you, and he runs into the next bar and brings his big brother. That's slightly delayed. And then there's called long-term effect, when you're fed up with being punished in this way, so you go to another town, hit the first little man you see, and get on the train and come back again. And it's not until you go to the big exhibition at Edinburgh Festival that you find this little bloke in the company of the giant friend of his, who probably boxed you. The point is, you cannot escape. Either the punishment is now, shortly, or later. And there is no complete escape. To come back to this, we want to be very, very clear about this process. We want to use this diagram as often as we can, because really it's the key to the whole process. Remember, that's the astronomical diagram of Mercury, the planet Mercury. The planet Mercury is the nearest one to the Sun. The Sun symbolizes will, and therefore that sign is the nearest thing to pure will you can get, if you understand it. It has a very, very erratic motion, a very peculiar orbit. It doesn't go simply around the Sun, as it would, but it goes in and out like this. Now, this erratic behavior of Mercury, like the behavior of the metal Mercury, quicksilver, which scatters all over the table when you hit it, falls into little balls, and then runs back together again, is the type of activity that we have to have. We must be quick. If we think of, say, all the people in this room, very quickly we must fly from one to the other and grasp all the significances. That is called mercurial behavior. The mercurial man is a quick man who can sense all over very, very quickly. He keeps his feelings spread out. When he's doing that, he's the nearest he can get in a formulated process to free will. That is to say, Mercury is next to the Sun. We said this was spirit and it was free. Now, you remember we did one diagram and said, imagine a motion going about like this and never crossing itself. We call this a motion of translation, which never becomes a rotation. It doesn't matter where it's going, it's called mazing. All the mazes used to be made like this. This maze activity does not make anything. Make, in Latin macula, a spot, implies rotation. Make, MK, substance close. Closure means draw a circle. So this state of the spirit, when Christ says the spirit bloweth where it listeth, no man knows where it came from, no man knows to where it goes, it's referring to the mazy activity of spirit. Spirit like that is not valuable, and therefore it decides to make the world soul. So when spirit is going along and it's mazing, it gets fed up with just mazing, so it goes like this. And when it's gone like that, it's made a closure. The next time it goes round it, it cuts off all the irregularities. And the first big turn it ever made is called the world soul, the anima mundi. This world soul is simply spirit closed. But it's not closed and cut off, because continuously spirit is flowing in and flowing out. The simplest form, take this sign, there it is. Spirit goes in, spirit goes out. In the zodiac, it is the sign of Taurus. Taurus is turn, T, Tor. We put U there instead of O, and we get the English word turn. This is the world soul. And then, whatever happens outside is a matter of no moment whatever to what goes on inside. The mazy stuff outside we call the Godhead. But the first big turn we call God. He is the world soul. Then inside that world soul, the soulish force goes round and round, and it makes the star system and the solar system and the planetary systems and the earth. Vegetables start growing out, animals and man, like we did before. We'll put the cross on for man, shoulders cliff have got off it. So ultimately, spirit making the world soul and pressing in makes an individual soul and integrates, fits together all the forces from inside and produces the man who is able to reflect on his origin. He knows who he is. And when St. Paul went to Greece, he found a stone monument and it said on it, to the unknown God. Because the Greeks were very logical. They had a pantheon of many, many gods. And they said, well, all these gods are all we know. Perhaps there's one we don't know. And we don't want to leave him out and annoy him. So we put up a monument to the unknown God. We call it Uga, or unknown God. And the unknown God, Paul looked at and said, what you ignorantly worship, we know. We know the unknown God. This is the unknown God, this mazy spirit. This is the known God. This was called Logos, the world soul, very well known to the Greeks. The Stoics taught about it very, very clearly. Plato talked about it. Socrates talked about it. But Heraclitus referred to this one, the fire spirit. And this one is not a known God, because K, N, to know, K means closure. Close now, know. Knowledge, now. What you can recall now is knowledge. What you cannot recall now is not knowledge for you. So if you had a fairy story you heard when you were two, and you
you can't remember it now, you don't know it. And you say, once I knew it, I think, vaguely. Now I do not know it, but somewhere I know it, but I don't know it now. Knowledge implies closure. So, the known God is the circle, the closed God. And outside this mazy one is called the unknown, that is the not closed God. So Paul was being very, very technical when he said to the Greeks, I know the unknown God, what human and what should we know? Because he knew very, very well that that one outside was closed by this band and excluded from the inside. It was known negatively. That is to say, if we imagine the spirit mazing about and then deciding to return, like that, we have enclosed, enclosed, and exclosed. There's exclusion, and here's inclusion. And we said before about our logic, we must assert these pairs of opposites. To draw the circle is to include and to exclude simultaneously. So that boundary is our letter K, the closure. And it says there is something inside and something outside the K. And we know both. We stop the inside getting out, and we stop the outside getting in. So Paul, quite rightly, said, we know that which you do not know. He was using the word know in two senses. You know what is inside. I know the infinite outside. Now, in the Tao Te Ching, it expresses this in another way. It says, the man who says he knows doesn't know, but the man who knows that he doesn't, he knows. This is a very simple piece of logic. The man who says that this closure is that is mistaken. That closure is merely the bound between the inside and the out. But the man who knows that that closure is merely a line of demarcation, the firmament of Genesis, which has waters below it, that is inside, and waters above it, living waters of the Spirit. The man who knows that the inside and the outside are the same, separated by a rotation band of the same, he knows what he's talking about. Spirit is soul, and soul is spirit. Now, this has to be understood for an individual being to become spiritually conscious. To be soulishly conscious is to be reasoning about the processes going on inside you. Counting your fingers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then saying that's 5. But being aware of the whole processes of your body in all its contacts with the universe means to be aware of the whole universe with yourself as center. And when you are doing that, it is not serial, it is simultaneous, and is called spiritual perception. This mazy activity is inside here as a frequency, so there's spirituality in the body. But actually, forces of the main, the circulation of the nervous fluid in the body. It's all determined by the fact that we're first round like an egg. And all the little eggs inside the big egg are individual souls or cells. I'm going to put F, spirit, self, C-E-L-L, self. The spirit in the cell, or the locked up spirit, we call a self. Now let us consider very carefully this. If we draw the sea flat on a calm day, we can call that universal substance. We signify it by M. M, with your mouth closed, mu, means substance. The Greek mu is used even in physics to symbolize mass. In mathematics, it's your glyph for mass energy. So that's lying down, quiescent. When the spirit, the air, blows out, spiritus is Latin for air, it then ripples.
and the ripples are very fine at first, like that. And we add an R to M for the ripple. That's Mary. That's called the Cosmic Mary. So when we talk about the Virgin Mary, we're talking about the cosmic ocean, not about a lady in history, merely, although there are such ladies in history. But we're talking about cosmic substance pressed upon by the Spirit. If we put the Spirit vertically, we've got the cross effect. And producing little ripples, turning M into Mary. Now, if the Spirit presses harder still, then it begins to get waves of a higher order. But the little ripples are still on the big one, like this. They never disappear. This is very important. Then later on, we can get bigger waves like this, with a great storm. There's the second wave on top of that one. This actually occurs in the sea if you've got good eyes. And here's the initial ripple on top of this one. It's very important to realize this. That little ripple is there all the time, and it is the original spiritual activity, and it is inside you now. It's far higher than the VHF radio frequencies of today. It is the fastest frequency there is in the universe, and it is already permeating your body, and it is always working for your good, and it can never cease to be. If you learn to calm your mind, you'll cut this big wave down to this one. If you manage to calm it again, you'll cut it down to this little tiny ripple, which is spirit. But even in the most turbulent moments of your life, that little tiny ripple is still there, the short wave, high frequency, which is spirit, and which makes you aware of the finest determinant there is. When you're aware of that one, you can know somebody's motive, know what they're feeling, long before they do. And you can insert, if you wish, new causes, and they haven't even seen the effect of the previous one. Then it's a question of being quick, fast. Short waves, high frequency, quick impulsations. That is the process going on in the body. And it is tremendously important to realize that that very fast frequency corresponds with this activity. And the next one corresponds with this activity. And this big turbulence corresponds with this activity. So, the nearer you come to your physical body, the more in danger you are of becoming unspiritual. That is to say, your physical body, although it's a necessary vehicle, is the coarsest thing you've got. You have another body, your subtle body of ideas, and another one still, your finest body of feeling, which takes these ripples. And another thing that the wave can do, and this is the doctrine of the four, the wave can rise up and go so high that it cannot fall down because it curls over and traps air inside there. And when it traps the air in the wave, then the air, as the water falls, is compressed and flows out, explodes, and reduces all the water to little discrete bubbles. Now that is the height of separativity. And you notice the thing that has caused it is air. Now, the title of the devil is the prince of the powers of the air. And the air, which we breathe, is the chief factor in our thinking process, which makes us separate ourselves analytically, like the petrifaction, the counting pebble again, and separate each being from every other being and pretend there is no continuity between them. So we say the intellect is the Cainish activity that murdered Abel. Abel means Ab, the father, El, God. God is our father, means we have one origin. Cain is Can. It's already cut it. And so, when the air, trapped by the wave that goes too high, blows all the water into froth, spume, spray, so on, it has reduced the substance
to discrete particles. Those particles will fly about in the air for a bit, and maybe blow a long way and fall down somewhere else. The important thing to realize is that the turbulence, allowing yourself to mount up in your feeling over somebody else, always produces spurious intellection, false ideas that you're separate. If we reduce it to the level of a relation between two men again, if those two men start talking to each other about how clever they are, and they search in their minds for ever newer and greater clevernesses, they become elevated, as we say, in their spirit, and they're so determined to prove themselves each the better man, that the will, mounting up, curls over and falls onto the intellect. It feeds the intellect, which then proceeds to break them in bits and produce perfectly false concepts that they are completely separate. And so the end result of a highly elevated argument of that kind is that generally both people say, I don't want ever to see you again, not now or in all eternity. And they turn their backs and walk away, forgetting that the earth is round. If they work far enough, they've bumped into each other again. The important thing is to see the logic of it. You have the substance isn't quite the same thing as the matter of your body. The matter of your body is substance plus T plus R. That T is fixation, that R is differentiation, that M is substance. It's the same as your mother, put those of the T and the spirit mother. MTR means your substance, crucified, differentiated. The fact that the head is different from the chest from the belly, and the legs from the arms, is all contained in R. The fact that that T fixes it at all means that you have bones in your rigid parts. And this substance is your flesh, which enables you to have some sort of relation between the different parts of your body. So, matter itself is highly complex. Pure substance is simply spatial occupancy or the general idea of resistance to force. But it is passive and it will take force into it, providing the force entering doesn't come too fast. If it comes too fast, it turns it into a motor. Notice the motor. You get a substance, applied force, and then the substance starts twirling about. That's a motor. And as the speed of it increases with the more energy you put in, so we say that the mass resistance of it is increasing. So that when a thing is moving very, very fast, like a man with his mind made up, it's no good talking to him because the mind is twirling round and round and round. First you've got to stop him and then talk. Because as long as he's turned his MTR into a motor, it is no good trying to penetrate him. If you get a bicycle wheel and still, you can put your finger between the spokes. If you twirl it and then do the same thing in all innocence, you lose the top of a finger, won't you? Because the speed with which the spokes come round again is so great that you haven't time to put the finger in and take it out before the next spoke has come. So the solidity of things is no more than another aspect of the materiality of things or the motoriality of things. Solidity is just velocity. So when we talk about atomic bombardment, an atom is nothing more than a little rotation system of power. When it goes very, very fast, suppose when we take a proton and an electron going around it and a hydrogen atom, and we want to fire at it another thing, we'll say a neutron. And we're firing a particle at this particle, and that particle's got a certain diameter, and it travels around its central proton in a certain length of time, but it travels around it very quickly. So you have to get a particle that travels so fast that it can get across the full width of the orbit, that is the diameter of that electron, before the electron has time to come round and hit it. So the question of penetrating an atom is accelerating a particle so much that it can get across the electron path before the electron has time to come and knock it out. So solidity is only velocity. The fact that the atom of the Greeks is really a motor or moving system was not noticed in the 19th century. But now we know it is so, it's not a theory. We have rotation to force, and when the rotation is terrifically fast, it is impenetrable to other force. This means that the top frequency of the universe is absolutely impenetrable by any other force. That means to say that spirit, the top frequency, can never be penetrated by matter, which is of lower frequencies. But having a high frequency itself, it can penetrate and does penetrate all matter. That is to say that when you have an X-ray photograph taken, you've got a certain kind of motion that has greater velocity than your flesh. So it can shine straight through your flesh. Your flesh is transparent to it because the rotations constituting your flesh are relatively slower than the radiation from that X-ray lamp. So it has to be seen that solidity is only speed. And the top speed is the most solid, which is a very strange inversion, because it means that spirit is the solidest thing there is in the universe, and matter is the least solid. And when we knock on things and think that is solid, that's delusion, because the fact that we can knock simply means that the velocity of the knuckle there and of the table is approximately the same. An X-ray will shine through it, because it's quicker than the constituent motions of the table. So spirit is the most solid. This is why Parmenides conceived the universe as a solid sphere. Solid. To us, that solidity is what spirit is and matter is not. Matter is made of a little rotation in the center, a colossal distance, and then an electron going round. The model of the atom is like the model of the solar system. You've got a sun, a lot of space, a lot more space, and here and there a little planet with a colossal orbit. Now all of the solar system is nearly all space, and inside the sun, there is more motion than there is outside, so the sun is more solid. So we can think of space as apparently exhausted of motion in the material world. There's a packet of motion called an electron. There's a packet called a proton. This one is going around this, and it's practically all space. So that matter is the most empty thing we know. And this is why the philosophers anciently said matter is the nearest thing to unreality you can conceive, because it is practically void. The sunyata of the Brahmins and the concept of sunyavada of the Buddhists is the idea of the clean and void, the empty fullness, the full emptiness. That the thing you think is solid is empty, and the thing you think is empty is solid. As a matter of fact, the distance between the walls here now is solid with radio waves, which we cannot hear unless we turn the radio on. The frequency is too fast for us, but the space between these walls is full of them. Change our rates of vibration of perception, and we'll see the place is solid, we won't be able to move. At that level, we wouldn't dare to move, it's too thick. So there's a limitation imposed on our senses, confine us to the lowest, the gross physical body, so that we can move about and have relations which we could not have at the top level with a solid. That is to say, absolutely full of motion. So at the spiritual end, the end of the very rapid vibrations, there is no space for people to fall out in. So therefore there is unity at that end. But at the gross material level, where the waves are coarser and the concentrations between there and there are divided by these apparent emptinesses, there we can fall out and get in a tizz with each other and go in different rooms. But at the same time we're going in different rooms, it is well to remember that whether we like it or not, our center is spirit and has got the highest frequency there is, and we have not disconnected ourselves from the person we're in the Lord with. In fact, with the talent and with the practice, we know it. Because if we walk into the next room cursing that person, it's that person we're cursing and not another one. We're still bound, even in our reason, to think about it and rehearse what we're going to say next time when we see them. So that our life is still conditioned by the thing we're supposed to cut ourselves off from. Now this fast frequency which runs through everything is called the waters, the living waters of life by Christ. Remember the woman at the well in Samaria, when he asks that woman for a drink, and she says to him, "Why do you talk to me? You're a Jew and I am not. You shouldn't talk to me." And he said, "If you knew to whom you spoke, you would have asked me to give you water, and I would give you living water." Now this living water is this free spiritual vibration. Dead water is that material stuff that comes out of taps, which has been getting steadily deader and deader ever since the corporation got wrong. Spring water is not reliable. Actually, if you get the water out of the tap and leave it all night, it goes into a kind of equilibrium. It becomes more substantial. We call it flat. It's become horizontal. If we then shake it up and down, that's the vertical, shake it up and down for 5 minutes and then drink it again, we find it's not flat. The flatness was simply the equilibration of forces. The forces inside balance themselves, and then it can't stimulate you anymore. The only thing that can stimulate you is free energy. If you get your flat water and give it a very, very good shaking and then try it, you have released, you've broken the energy link between the molecules. You've released a certain amount of energy, and then you can derive stimulation from it. It feels fresh. Hence the statement, shake your bottle. Now, have we got any particular thing that we'd like to discuss about now? Kinds of fools, the congenital idiot fool and the fool for Christ's sake. Now, F is P. Let's just say that the sound F is simply the sound P with the air blown through it. It blows it. Twist it. Blow the air through the sentiment. It's quite a legitimate sound shift to change F to P, P to B, B to P. Pool, a very good game for gentlemen. Polo is the pilo, the reason. Now there are two kinds of fools, those who are fools under the law, and those who know about the law and behave as if they were fools. Now being a fool for Christ's sake is recognizing that when an income tax form comes to you, that it is beyond understanding. You return it written, "Cannot understand." See, and that sort of thing. Well, that's being a fool for Christ. That is to say, there is a way of understanding the law so that you can circumvent the law. Not the law of God, that's impossible to circumvent, but the law of man. Now, you remember the statement about the coin? Is it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar or not? Christ doesn't say yes, and he doesn't say no. He wouldn't dream of being so naive to say either of those things. He says, "Show me a coin." And they show him a coin, and he looks on. Whose head is this? Caesar's head. Then he says, "Take the head off the coin, but don't take any of the metal and give it to Caesar."
God. He says, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And it says in the book that the earth is God's footstool, and the metal came out of the earth, so that metal is part of God's footstool. But the inscription of Caesar, if he can get it off without taking the metal, is his. They said it's trying to catch him. But he always uses this horn diagram, you see, the paralogic, where the identity of opposites is asserted all the time. If you're a congenital idiot fool, you might be used as a rhesus monkey and sent up in a Sputnik or something. But if you are a fool for Christ's sake, it isn't likely that it can be done on you, because you will know how to circumvent it. So this fool word is only the pylon disguise again. It's the knowledge of this fact that a pebble dropping on the pool causes ripples. So you could say, if I speak now, minds will vibrate and things will be said, some rude, some not, and so on. The congenital idiot just speaks and says his best word. See, maybe you can get fed, because people are not terrified of the weak. This is why if you're born dead or idiotic, nobody's scared of you. When you're very, very little, people will feed you, because you're not yet an enemy, only potentially. When you're old enough to fight your own battle, you become an enemy, and you will remain an enemy until you become very, very ill again and are carted off the ground. So the newly born, the idiots, and the dead or dying are nice people, but in between, they're not. That's very important. So to understand this law of stimulus, everything said, everything done, it's a stimulus. If you know that, don't be surprised. And then when somebody comes along to stimulate your sensorium, the final notice or something, then you know what's going to happen. There will arise in you, if you have been trained in society, if you've been to school, like William Blake said, and flogged into following this town before, on reading that red notice, either or could cut your water off or something. When that happens, there will arise in you, if you have been trained, panic. But if you know that it's a product of the training, the materiality, and the present stimulus, you will say, ripples upon the mind. And you won't bother about it. That needs great courage to do this, to see something, to watch a reverberation in your own organism which has come from an outside source. Somebody comes along to you and says something rude to you, and produces a ripple. Supposing you understand the theory of substance reaction to a stimulus, you're not surprised. You say, so there's an unpleasant reaction, but it was an unpleasant fellow. So see? Like produces like. So you say, well, I don't expect a pleasant reaction from that unpleasant fellow. And it's the ability to be able to say this that constitutes the real fool for Christ's sake. Because then what you do is, Christ, as far as you're concerned, is the circle and the cross. There's the limit of your being, or that's your feeling, and that cross is your idea. You have to integrate all your ideas, and you can only do so with the aid of stimuli. So when a stimulus comes from head office, for a specific thing, what it ought to do to you is send you to the central library to see whether they're legally entitled to send you that notice. That's the correct thing to do. About 2 years ago, a stimulus came to me in the same way, totally unconnected sources. Three ladies all said to me in the same week, and they didn't know each other, do we have to go on a jury? We don't want to. Well, it was a stimulus, I could have said. Oh, what are you talking to me about? I said, loophole, the legal eagle says you don't have to go. On principle. So they said, what do you mean? I said, well, the law is trained. And therefore, there's a way out of it. I said, however, I'll get you the details and copy them down. So I went to the central library. I got up a gentleman who has buried the spirit of God and lost a body whose name is Howlsbury. The Howls means spirit, and spirit in the volume of the law. So I then looked up the law for juries, and it said, people who are exempt from serving on a jury. There was a list of people, which means nearly everybody. You see, all government officials, all post office officials, the medical profession, all sorts of things, you see, going on and on and on and on. I was looking at the people that were not exempt. See? And then right at the end it said, and as for ladies, it said, they can just not bother, because they can say, I'm indisposed. But it's good enough. So I wrote all this down for them, and I had some copies typed for fun. And I distributed them to different people. See? Now this produced a great conflict, because one man had already made the statement that there is no way of getting out of serving on the jury. And he made the statement to one of the women. And he had declared himself in public. Whereupon she handed him one of these typewritten sheets with references. And he retired and hasn't been seen since. The important thing was that a stimulus came, and instead of rejecting it, saying it's too much trouble, let the direction of the stimulus take you to the source of the information and use the energy of the stimulus to do the research, because it isn't difficult. If somebody comes to you with a specific problem, they state it, it cannons onto certain parts of your sensorium and equips them to get the information if you'll overcome your physical inertia and go and get it. And that's being a fool for Christ's sake. Christ is the integrated man. And in order to become the integrated man, you'll have to be that kind of a fool. That is to say, you will have to be at everybody's beck and call. When the stimulus comes, respond. Your duty, it's only the shadow of love in any case. Get on with it. And the stimulus will work inside you and rotate and discursively reason and produce the result. If you do that quite honestly, you will find all the universe is conspiring to educate you and supplying you with the energy. And the opposite to that is when you reject every inquiry and you're too tired to help. And then you become yet tireder. Because the law is, if you develop your talents, you'll be given more. If you refuse to develop them, they'll be taken away, even those which you have. Because you're either gaining or losing energy all the time. And when you are willing, you are gaining energy. When you are helpful, you're gaining it. And when you refuse to help for any reason whatever, you are losing energy. Because you have actually failed to contain the stimulus.
You were going to mention earlier on why Peter was requested to be crucified at St. James.
Well, because he had betrayed on the three levels his own integration possibility, that is the Christ in him, he realized that he was upside down in this sense. Remember, we said this was the unfallen one, didn't we? And this was the fallen one. Do you remember that? This one was the unfallen man, and that one was the fallen man. Now Peter, the stone man, is the man who has counted in his head and insists that you should count everything. That cross is dominating him. So he said, don't crucify me like that when I am martyred. Turn me that way up. That is the paralogic, the identity of opposites. This is tyranny. The message comes from the earth. There's the earth. Comes here, climbs up, and becomes ideation. And goes down in the reaction. So he's entirely conditioned by the material world. And he thought he was the right way up when he was counting Simon Peter. Then he discovered it only got him into trouble. trouble and betrayed his own integration. So when he finally managed to bring himself to the point of accepting martyrdom, he said, "Do me upside down, that is this way. Now I will be fed from the infinite spirit." And that process will go on like this. And all my fruits will go back into the spirit. He's then called the doorway of the spirit. You must realize that in all the great religions, you're not up against haphazard emotional speculations. You're up against what is called revelation. Revelation is revealing. The book of Revelation is the hardest book, isn't it, in the Bible. Revelation, veil. Put another veil on, truth. So it doesn't mean to disclose. It doesn't mean to explain anything. It means to put further veils. Always further veils. Because if you don't have the interest to lift the veil up, you shouldn't get to know what's underneath. When I was very little, my father used to say to me, "Never tell the truth in public, because the truth is like a naked lady and has no place in the drawing room." And he meant to say that every person has a rotating system of ideas, one of these fallen men. They've got their tyranny of form there, and their souls are turbulating with the stuff that's come to the material world. Their minds are called made up. Or bunged up, so that if you tell them the truth will always contradict that which they think they know. For instance, a man says, "The devil is wicked." If you said to him, "Yes, he's very, very wicked, I love the devil," you see, then he'd think you're a devil worshipper. But he doesn't know what the devil is, he doesn't know what wicked is, he doesn't know anything. If you said, "Yes, the devil is wicked," means God is a very quick fellow. Then he thinks you are juggling with words. And you are. But you're a good juggler. Juggle itself is made from God. It's real. The Jew in juggle is God. Yahweh. And the gla in it is the gil, gal, the wheel. The one where Samson was. You know, Samson gets something wheels. It's Samson and Gilgal. And in the Babylonian epic, his title is the Epic of Gilgamesh. Mesh is Moses. Gilgal means wheel. And when the wheel turns in your soul, there is an issue, which is Mesh. So when your reason goes down, it produces a result. So it's Gilgamesh. If you know what you're talking about, there are no mysteries. And if you study these fundamental symbols and then apply the rule, you will realize that it is quite wrong to put forward a truth in its entire disclosed form. Because in order to do so, you would frighten everybody to death. Only because they have been trained in erroneous ideas. They haven't understood anything. Once upon a time, Uranus and Gaia got married and gave birth to Kronos. It's a Greek myth. What does it mean? Heaven married the earth and gave birth to time. How nice for them. So, heaven is force, earth is mass inertia. That force applied itself on that mass inertia and it began to rotate. That's time. Time is rotation. So we say that Kronos is the child of heaven and earth. It has a meaning. There's another story, a lady called Eurynome, which means wide wanderer. This is the philosophy of creation. She wandered about, not knowing where to go. She decided to go south. At that time, there was nowhere. So she decided to go south. And she moved towards the south so rapidly, she created a draft behind her. And this draft was the north wind. And when she felt the north wind blowing on her, she didn't know that she'd caused it. But she thought it was a man. So she turned around and grabbed him. And they began to rotate an Orpheon. Big circular serpent was born. And Orpheon then fell in love with Eurynome, this wide wanderer, and copulated with her and produced the world.
And they were doing very nicely in their marriage until Orpheum stood up and said, I have created the world. Whereupon she just lifted up one of her heels and knocked his teeth out. That's a myth. What does it mean? Wide wonder means this mazy energy that we said before that doesn't rotate. But when it's going along, he said, it went to the south. Now the south pole in your body is the sensual part of the body. So it means looking for sensuous experience. Sense experience leads the newborn child to suck milk from its mother. It's not intellection, it's pleasure. Moving to the south is pleasure. The draft created behind comes from this end. And it means that when you move into sensuous experience, you automatically get ideas following you. And when you realize you've got an idea out of your experience, the idea is worth turning round and grabbing at, because it clarifies what you're trying to get. So first you start doing something vaguely. Out of your vague doing arises clarity. And you turn round and grab the clarity. That's a man. And you have a relation with the clarity and the unclarity. That is, with the idea and the will. And out of the two of them, you produce a circulation of the discursive reasoning process, or Orpheum, the great serpent. But he, the discursive reasoner, always says, alone I did it. Whereupon you kick out his teeth. That is the analytic, the dense, the analytical aspect. And you say to him, you can't analyze unless there is a continuum, and I am the continuum. That's kicking his teeth out. Now, myths are very, very funny things. But they contain cosmic truths hidden in them. So it's really tremendously important to realize that all the things we need to know are already known, but they are veiled. We have to take the veils. Who is the red dragon in the Revelation? Who is the woman sitting on many waters, etc., etc.? The Greeks took the region from the navel and the stomach, and they call it the epitome, and said that is the red dragon. That's the part that gets really mad in you and turbulates. If somebody annoys you, it spoils your digestion. And you feel like chewing them up. That's the dragon in you, the fiery red dragon. That fiery red dragon will always devour the Christ child if you let it. That is, it will steal the energy that should be working up here towards integration and devour it and turn it into bad temper. Because the funny thing about this fellow is, you can find a million reasons why somebody's no good if they've hurt him. And he never tends to find a reason why somebody's good if they're doing a good turn. So he's up to something. So that particular part has no real pure mountain.
I'm very, very sorry.
conditioning techniques that you read about, just actually quite a small flood of books on conditioning techniques. They seem to be installing mechanisms, and they are a bunch of books on them, and they appear to be effective.
Well, you mean the stuff based on the Pavlov reflex?
Yes.
Well, it's, first of all, the modern method of doing it isn't modern. It's very ancient. And all that's modern about it is exposing it to the public. And again, it's another weapon. It's enough to paralyze most people to think about it. At some threshold work and so on. The idea is very, very simple, and it is an essential of any real work that you should learn to condition yourself. Because conditions exist, don't they? Conditioning means setting up conditions inside your organism. If you get a child, a new child, and telling horrible stories, that things are waiting in the coal to grab it, things are in the stairs, things are under the carpets, things are hanging on the windows, yellow and green, red teeth and so on, you can insert into the child lots of horrible images, can't you? When the child then tries to think, all it gets is a series of horrible images. And it lives a nightmarish existence. Anybody knows that, don't they? There's nothing new about the principle. What's new is the application of the principle to open analysis of political and other conditioning factors. Hitler used exactly the same method that's been used by the ancient Egyptians and others. Get hold of the children, print school books with certain behaviour patterns in them, make the educational system gram ideas in them through their years, make them recite things. All that is a conditioning process which produces a little Nazi.
The method suggested that nearly all auto-hypnotic rather than rational. I wonder if you thought they were useful.
No, they're not auto-hypnotic. Auto-hypnotic means you do it on yourself. And these people are not doing it on themselves, they're having it done on them. We call it hetero-suggestion when somebody else does it. If you could suggest to yourself, it is probable that you'd suggest decent stuff if you knew any. You wouldn't try to lower your resistance, would you? You try to increase it. But it's a function of what we call the fascist, the extreme right wing, and the communist, the extreme left wing, who are identical. I call extreme, as you take a pole and you write on it extreme left, extreme right, and you bend it around and put them together. The extreme right wing means state dictatorship. The extreme left wing means the same thing in disguise, because it means nationalisation. The only real part is the liberal part in the middle. The part of freedom, liberal means free. Now, there is a real battle going on between people who want to dominate other people and some other people who want to be free. And masses of people, millions, are not in the battle at all. They merely suffer the consequences. A handful of men want to rule the world by conditioning it. Another handful of men want to be free from the conditioning, and they fight the men that want to make the conditions. And the masses of people don't know what's going on over their heads. This conditioning process is a real process. It goes on from the moment you're born and before, from the moment of conception. Conditioning is there. What we have to do is set up such conditions inside ourselves, that is, such true idea systems, that we're quite immune to external indoctrination. We have an analytical device, which is, again, a conditioning of our soul. And the conditions that we set up are true conditions, so that when a stimulus comes in, propaganda, it is analysed by our truth mechanism, so that the external condition is defeated by the internal condition. And this must be done. There's no other way of gaining freedom. other than by conditioning yourself to be free.
So it was just attempt to bypass those things, appeal directly to the
lowest common denominator.
Yes.
Well, if you're talking to the mass of people, it's no good talking intellectually. It isn't for them. Only individuals can work. You can't get 2,000 million people in the world, which is what there are, put them together into a large hall and say, now listen to this, it's the truth, and now go home and practice it. In fact, you have to start with one or two or a dozen. And then, if they carry on with the work, they might teach one of them, make a dozen, and so on, and spread. But when you compare that and the time factor involved with the total population of the earth, it's nothing. It's throwing a pebble in the ocean. And therefore, no real influence will be had on masses of people by the few people who work for thousands of years. The crucifixion of Christ is nearly 2,000 years old. What effect has it had on the mob? It has added another superstition to the ones they had. It hasn't made them work. You get a few people, very, very few, who work on what he was talking about. Necessarily a few. Many are called, few chosen. Not all are called, many are called. And out of those, few are chosen. Because very few want to do the work. Many are called, come and work. Out of all those that come, most of them have a wrong motive. So you don't choose out of those with the wrong motive and tell them the kind of processes that you can only do with the right motive. First, many call. You don't call the football crowds a waste of time. You call the many who would like to learn, and you select from those the few who have the pure motive, the right reason for wanting to learn. And that will always be so. When Christ said, the poor have you always with you, he meant always. As long as there are people, there will be masses of people not interested in individual work, and many would like to have power, and the few would like it for that reason. That's in all historic times. So this conditioning factor, which has become popularized, is not a new emergent at all. It's just had the lid taken off it a bit. Somebody complained about some threshold on the key.
That we cannot hear it as individual human beings is simply because the ear is deliberately finited. Otherwise you would hear the earth going round. If you get an ordinary cup and just speak into it, you'll hear the echo back in the form. If you listen to a kettle, when it starts to boil, you'll hear it going. And then just when it starts to go round, you'll hear it going. When it starts really rotating, you'll hear the vowel change. You can tell by the vowel change when it's boiling. This means there's a definite meaning for every letter, and therefore for every word compounded of letters. There's a definite form in every sound. Do you know the Chladni figures of sand on a violin or on a piece of glass? You play a certain note, say middle C, and a certain shape appears. You play F, another shape appears. You play C again, when the original shape appears. There's a definite relation between sound and form, between the name and the thing. And this is why it is said that with God, to speak is to create. When he makes his first sphere, it says, that's all. That's E, O, and V, in all form of V. That's G, O, Va, to develop. That V means develop. So Jehovah is already contained in there as a diagram. It means each and all related. The relations between each and all. That follows that when you've meditated on the relation between each and all, you have exhausted significance, haven't you? So that word Jehovah is not called the most powerful name for nothing, is it? And when we add an S to it, it turns into Jesus. Yehovah becomes Yehoshua.
maybe probably something just struck me then. I might be getting mixed up with that feeling, you know. There's two different types of feeling that I can feel. There's personal things, things around you, things you understand.
Mm-hmm.
There's another type of feeling. Nothing to do with
you mean the feeling of the uncomprehended?
It's like an asking for knowledge, type compassion. That word would suit it, but
to
me, like, my understanding of that word wouldn't cover it.
Well, the ancients used the word awe for that. The sense of awe. You have a particular feeling, you know so and so.
No, isn't it? If I link the words with that type of feeling,
mm-hmm.
I get a much real understanding of it. And a word with ordinary feeling.
You know,
I think I can understand that. Yes.
Now, if you get hold of the big feeling, for instance, if you see that this all pre-existed the earth, pre-existed the solar system, pre-existed the whole of the sidereal system, every star, everything else, is inside a big sphere. In him we live, move and have our being. And when we say that all, it refers to the insubstantial sphere, which Plato called the world of ideas. When we close our lips on it, and we say all, on with the lips closed, we say om. Okay. That's the yogi om, which means all substance. O on its own means all, om means all substance. The Hebrew yom means day. Yom. Y-O-M. That ya is the drawing of a hand and it means to posit, to create. That's the pebble. There's the limit of the ripple. Here's the ripple pattern running through. This is what goes on. And that fills up the universe with form. When the mouth is not closed, we call it the world of ideas, and when the mouth is closed, we call it the world of substance. So we then get a grasp. This is what we call a feeling for the language, the Sprachgefühl, the Germans call it. To feel what it means quite independently of what you've been told it means. Thus the word urge, pronounced urg, has a more fundamental, dark feeling about it, hasn't it? Urg. If we take the word orgasm, you see, org is a darker word than urge, isn't it? If we flatten the vowel in English, it's no longer urgeful, is it? So in the south of England, they say love, and in good old Yorkshire, they say love. And the reason is they don't do it the same way in London as they do it in Yorkshire. In Yorkshire, it's more fundamental, more rudimentary. You see the idea? Now, if we take a German word, like the German word for a cause is Ursache. Cause. Ursache. What a lovely sound. If you mean Ursache. Now, that's to the German mind. So when they say the Sprachgefühl, you see, they know what it means, the Ursache. And the Latin causus is this, right. That's not an Ursache, is it? And the Ursache is only possible for the German. The Ursache. The war, the Krieg, the Schlacht. You see, those are terrible words, aren't they? English is relatively civilized. Underneath all those flattened vowels of English, underneath the bands and the love and the other stuff, you see, there's jolly good stuff. Dealing on with it. You see? The Saxon English, unpolluted by Norman French, is closer to the German, and it's more rudimentary. Now, when you do that and get down to this feeling of words, and then you reread something you think you've understood before, you will discover that what you thought was understanding was intellectualism. And underneath it is another thing, totally different, a feeling, and suddenly you become aware of what politicians do when they make a special propaganda speech. They choose certain words because they're more urgeful than others. You see, thus, if our army moves away from their army, we call it a withdrawal of our troops to previously ascertained positions of great strength. If the enemy do the same, we say they flee in disorder. Only, it's the same motion. Well, we find out over the V there, you see, and the Russians are there, and the Germans are there. In the German papers it said, an arrowhead strikes into the Russian armies. And in the Russian papers it said, we have accomplished a pincer movement. You see, it's definition, isn't it? There's one concrete fact, and you can please yourself how you describe it. And if you want to get people on the move, you use all the vowels that are low, the oo, the o. You see, if you want to make people sentimental, choose words with a, e in it. A is peculiarly mawkish and self-pity. When babies cry, a, that's when they're sorry for themselves. When they get really mad, it doesn't go a, it goes ah. You see? And they never say e until they're beginning to formulate intellectually, like Bertrand Russell. And then they talk like that, you see? The whole universe is precisely a mathematical device. Bring it right up and keep the tongue up in E form. And this is tremendously important because you cannot understand the word unless you pronounce it in the way that it should be pronounced in each context. Because its meaning changes when you change the pronunciation. The German word for love is Liebe. You see, and L-I-E-B is love root, and L-E-I-B, the same letter as Anglian, is life, body. So we know from that that Liebe, Leibe. Germans love bodies. Because when they talk about love, they're talking about body anagram. And praise is Loben. They praise bodies. You see? So you know what they're talking about. They're a very meaty folk.
And yet, the light only shows its strength by the shadow that it casts out of Germany. Recently, from the greatest philosophy.
Name one.
Nietzsche.
Right, you see, you say Nietzsche. Now, what is his contribution? You say, out of Germany. Do you know he's Polish?
No.
The whole of the writing is about Nietzsche by Elizabeth First and Nietzsche, his sister. We are not Germans. Yes. We are Poles. We came here and we hate the Germans. Mm. And we're trying to enlighten them. You see, out of Germany, Schopenhauer,
yeah.
Pessimism. Do you know where he got it from? A misunderstanding of the Hindu Upanishads. He didn't do anything until he read the Hindu Upanishads, and then he took them over and he tried to get the position that Hegel had. And Hegel was a big fellow. And Schopenhauer wanted to be revered too, but he failed and didn't get the appointment. So he became very, very pessimistic.
Kant.
Mm-hmm. Kant was a Scotsman. Mm. Spelled C-A-N-T until they got in Germany. And because the Germans pronounced C, and they used to call him Herzant, they put a K there instead, because in Latin called Herzant. He wanted to be Kant, like he was in Scotland.
When I tried to infer then, in a country where there's great turbulence, it must hit certain mind.
But he's turbulent philosophies.
Yes, but you don't necessarily.
Do you mean by great philosophies, turbulent philosophies? Yes. Turbulent philosophies.
Well, if you live in a country, say, where there's no great turbulence,
mm-hmm.
I don't know this, I'm asking this. Could any great men exist in that country?
What do you mean by great? Have a look at this word and tell me what it means.
But you know what I mean.
How big are they? You don't mean physically, do you? No. Do you mean intellectually?
No.
Alexander was a great man, and the thought never crossed his head. He just went round and flattened everyone, didn't he? And then blew a few.
Would they be asleep or more awake?
That depends which they were. Some would have gone to sleep and some would have been awakened by the stimulus. God has made of one blood all nations. And in spite of that, some of them moved into Africa. Some went to China, some went into Europe, some stayed where they were. Their cultures developed out of the terrain stimulus and their biological response. There's no merit in individuals. because everything comes to them as a stimulus and they react. They're a bit of protein.
If that stimulus doesn't come to them,
then they don't develop.
Well, that's exactly what I meant before. You see, for instance, that a man with great talents, I don't mean that great either, I mean wise talents, then, if that's the best way. But just a moment now,
yes.
Say he lived in a country that was full of inertia, that everything was peaceful, everything was comfortable, life was easy.
Switzerland.
Yeah, I don't know any country at all. Not going to lay me down.
No.
Could he be used? Christ was born in turbulent times. If he'd have been born in another time, say he'd been born in a peaceful country where the living conditions were, say, 100% better.
You mean, could spirit have decided to pick him up and remove him into a turbulent time or start a revolution?
But, you see, as I look at it, only these people could be born in such times. That's as I understand it.
Yes, but it isn't true. You see, there's a man's soul and their spirit and their body stimulus hitting him. Now, assume that body stimulus is fairly even and it's an uneventful life. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, that's only one man. There may be millions of men. And it may be that this spirit, which is quite aware that there's another body over here and some more down here, might say, those are being too turbulent. Here's a nice peaceful one, move him over here. Although he's in a peaceful country, he may come out of there. William Tell was in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. You see, you cannot tell, because the spirit bloweth where it listeth. It could go into darkest Salford and produce a genius if it wanted to do it. And it can go in a very turbulent country for a time, like Germany during the 30 Years' War, England during the 100 Years' War. Plenty of turbulence, but no genius. And then it can come into another period. The great heyday of the Greeks, when they produced their best philosophers, was a time of relative leisure for them, because they had slaves underneath them. They were a democracy with a slave foundation. To be democrats for the Greeks was to be citizens.
But then for a wise man to see a slave, it wouldn't be peaceful for him to see that.
Why not? Christ was a wise man, and he said, the poor have you always with you.
I know that, but he must have felt for it.
He did.
Well, then, his mind must have been turbulent, that's a change. How do I see it?
It must have been turbulent. You mean to say it must have seen what
he
is?
He must have suffered for them.
Suffer meant to say that he felt what they felt.
He must have done.
You mean, don't think that that's negative. You have to be very careful about that word, suffer. It means simply to be sub-facere. You are underneath what is being done. Something is being done to you. Now, Christ could have done what he liked, but he allowed the situation to act on him because he'd come for a very special reason, to show people how to take suffering. People didn't like suffering. They were trying to get out of it. He says, you'll never get out that way. Every time you react against suffering, you get bonked again because, like Paul says, sin is the strength of the law. One man sins, and immediately the king says, let's have 1 million policemen. Keep them all in order. It's true that only one sinned, but it's good enough. It'll justify the policemen.
But a man must carry another man's sin. It's like seeing an accident. Sometimes the onlooker feels it worse than the person who's had the accident. I've seen worse suffering in onlookers many times.
Yes, but you see, there's genuine suffering in the sense of being underneath, allowing the thing to come at you in order to feel his position, and there's something totally different, the sentimentality that paralyzes your willpower. And there's some people that if somebody falls on the road and gets knocked down, they're so suffering with them that they can't go and pick them up. I've seen that.
No, that I don't mean that.
You see, you're talking about sympathy, same feeling. Sympathy and same feeling. Christ had sympathy, he felt with them. Buddha had sympathy, compassion with them, he felt with them. That does not mean to say that he wanted to stop what they were suffering. If he had done, he would have said, stop this suffering. He didn't. He said, take up your cross daily, that suffering that you've got, and learn to grow by it. Don't fight against it, accept it.
But he must have understood and felt with them.
Of course he did.
Well,
Because I've noticed that particularly in the children, that if they get hurt, they go to the parents who can offer them most sympathy. And they know that instinctively.
A child, if the child is brought up on its own, or with wolves, or with deer, or so and so, does not run to a human being if it gets hurt.
I didn't mean.
So its instinct does not send it. You know the case of Amal and her sister in India were brought up by wolves. Mm-hmm. When they tried to humanize them, they both died. Because the wolf pattern was in them. One was 8 and the other was 14 when they died. They had an English minister there who tried to bring them up with his wife and others, but they failed. Because they had been conditioned. They'd got wolf pattern in them. And it couldn't be broken. It was too painful for them to break it. When a child runs to the mother, it's because the mummy has already given it some sympathy. That isn't instinct. It's instinct that makes the child suck milk from his mother. You must distinguish between instinct, which is internal to it from birth and hereditament, and something totally different, a conditioned reflex caused by the sympathy of the parents manifesting because they say, that's my child. Because very, very often the woman would pick up her own child and not pick up another child. Or she'll say, poor little Robbie, and Jackie shouldn't have pushed you. And she doesn't want to know who started it. She just automatically said, that is mine, that's possessiveness. And you have to distinguish very carefully between this, because there is a horrible thing called sentimentality, which is nothing like real feeling. Real feeling can suffer with somebody, have compassion with them, and still say to them, bear it and try to understand it. Don't dodge it. Dodging it is no good for you. It's very important to realize that. Sentimentality isn't the same thing as sentiment. When you begin to get this remorse you were talking about, which depends on a clash between true ideas of the wholeness of the universe and particular stimulation that makes you behave badly, both in the same man, clashing two totally different things, a behavior pattern from outside and what you ought to do from inside. The disparity of them produces a feeling in you, giving rise to the state you call remorse. And if you're not careful, you can fall into a horrible state called self-pity, which is the biggest poison in the world. What you ought to do in a state of remorse, say, bad job, I'm getting sensitive. It means that the idea of truth is increasing in me, and it's battling with the external situation and making me feel terribly uncomfortable. Goody, goody. I feel terribly uncomfortable now. I'm getting sensitive. It's very important. If you try to dodge that feeling and think you're getting worse when you're getting better, you can throw the whole thing away by mistake.
You couldn't dodge it in the job I've got.
Well, you ought to do that, though.
Yes.